The reading's from Luke 5, starting at verse 33, and that can be found on page 1038. And they said to him, "The disciples of John fast often and offer prayers, and so do the disciples of the Pharisees, but yours eat and drink." And Jesus said to them, "Can you make wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast in those days." He also told them a parable. "No one tears a piece from a new garment and puts it on an old garment. If he does, he will tear the new, and the piece from the new will not match the old. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the new wine will burst the skins, and it will be spilled, and the skins will be destroyed. But new wine must be put into fresh wineskins. And no one, after drinking old wine, desires new, for he says, 'The old is good.'" On a Sabbath, while he was going through the grain fields, his disciples plucked and ate some ears of corn, rubbing them in their hands. But some of the Pharisees said, "Why are you doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath?" And Jesus answered them, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and took and ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for any but the priests to eat, and also gave it to those with him? And he said to them, 'The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath.' On another Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and was teaching, and a man was there whose right hand was withered. And the scribes and the Pharisees watched him to see whether he would heal on the Sabbath, so they might find a reason to accuse him. But he knew their thoughts, and he said to the man with the withered hand, 'Come and stand here.' And he rose and stood there. And Jesus said to them, 'I ask you, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to destroy it?' And after looking around at them, he said to him, 'Stretch out your hand.' And he did so, and his hand was restored. But they were filled with fury and discussed with one another what they might do to Jesus. In those days he went out to the mountain to pray, and all night he continued in prayer to God. And when the day came, he called his disciples and chose from them 12, whom he named apostles: Simon, who he named Peter, and Andrew his brother, and James and John, and Philip and Bartholomew, and Matthew and Thomas, and James the son of Alphaeus, and Simon, who was called the Zealot, and Judas the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. And he came down with them and stood on a level place with a great crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people from all Judea and Jerusalem and the sea coast of Tyre and Sidon, who came to hear him and to be healed of their diseases. And those who were troubled with unclean spirits were cured, and all the crowd sought to touch him, for power came out from him and healed them all."
Fran, thanks very much for reading, and let me welcome you again. Great to have you with us. We're always thrilled to welcome new folk among us, and especially at this time of year with so many people new to London, we're thrilled that you've found your way to join us. Let me start by telling you a story. So there was this student, okay, he's a guy, he lives in London, and he's learning how to fend for himself domestically. His mum lives far away, he doesn't have a girlfriend, and by the way, this is made up, sorry, some of the student lads are a little bit worried about where this is going. It's a completely fictional story, but he's got this t-shirt, he really loves his t-shirt, but the problem with his t-shirt is it's got a hole in it, and the hole just keeps getting bigger. Well, eventually he decides that he's going to have to do something about this, so he says, "I know my mum's not here with the sewing kit, I don't have a girlfriend to help me out. Actually, maybe this is part of the problem, maybe this is why there isn't a girlfriend. I'm going to have to do something about this." So he wanders down to Oxford Street, goes into Gap, and he buys a shiny new green t-shirt. Gets home and thinks, there you go, problem solved. As he begins to cut a big piece out of the new t-shirt and sticks it onto the old. By the way, can I just say that that is not a new t-shirt? It's got holes in it as well. No new t-shirts were harmed in this illustration. So he sticks the new patch onto the old. And basically, the point is, And that's basically Jesus' point, if you have a look at verse 36. That would be an absurd thing to do. Verse 36, no one tears a piece from a new garment and puts it on an old garment. If he does, he will tear the new, and the piece from the old will not match the new. So where is it? Here's our new t-shirt. That is not a good look, is it, with a big hole at the bottom? And that is definitely not a good look either. That is the point. And Jesus is using this as an illustration to a crowd of people who loved their old religious system. And the moral of the story from Jesus is, if you think I'm going to patch nicely onto your system, then you've totally missed the point. My new way and your old way do not mix. The wineskin illustration in verse 37 basically makes the same point. If you're going to get me, says Jesus, you're going to have to bin the old way completely and be prepared to put on something that's totally fresh and new. And that isn't going to be easy. For them, change is never easy. You know, some of us do actually feel that when it comes to silly little things like clothes. You know, to let go of something old and familiar can be uncomfortable, can't it? Ramp that up to the level of somebody changing their religion, changing your whole identity, the thing you've built your whole security around. That could be really difficult. The warning from Jesus here is maybe too difficult. Because once people have tasted an old way, it's just very difficult for them to accept something new. Verse 39. No one after drinking old wine desires new, for he says, the old is good. Jesus is speaking to people who think the old is good. And actually it becomes an interesting case study on what happens generally when Jesus and religion come head to head. It's worth clarifying before we go on here, old versus new is not about Old Testament versus the New Testament. One of Luke's biggest concerns is to show us that Jesus fits with the Old Testament, that he fits with all of its promises and is completely in line with its expectations. The old here is an old religious culture that you certainly find there in the first part of the Bible, but it's the religious culture of the Pharisees who were so influential in the Judaism of Jesus' day. And it's a culture that was a complete perversion of what it meant actually to be the people of God. Well, if you've got the sheet there, you'll see some points we're going to rattle through. It's a few incidents here told quickly in one movement, so I thought slightly differently today. What we'll do is we'll go through the whole of the story fairly quickly first, and then we'll look at a few of the implications. And just as we track through the story, be thinking about it in these categories, old versus new. Which one do you prefer? And can we see why it is that they are not compatible? So the first thing is why Jesus and the old religion don't mix. This follows straight on from where we were last week, if you were here. And it's a bit like one of those old cowboy movies, if you've seen those, in the way the mood develops here. So first of all, the new hero rocks into town. At first, he's just causing a little bit of tension because maybe he's sat in the wrong place in the saloon bar or knocked over somebody's drink. But soon the locals begin twitching to find their weapons as we build up to the big showdown. As the action begins, it seems that we're still at Levi's feast, where we ended last week. Do you remember Levi, Phil Mitchell, the guy who's become a Christian, the gangster who's become a Christian, which Jesus explained in the punchline, verse 32, his great mission statement, I've not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. And verse 33 just seems to follow on here as part of that same conversation. So, really, Jesus, say the Pharisees and their scribes. You know, this doesn't look a lot like repentance. This looks more like party time. You know, this religion that you say you're calling sinners to doesn't look very religious. Verse 33. And they said to him, the disciples of John fast often and offer prayers, and so do the disciples of the Pharisees, but yours eat and drink. You know, we've noticed, Jesus, in the Evening Standard poll of religiousness, that your disciples don't seem to come out very well. Us Pharisees fast all the time, twice a week, we find out later in Luke's Gospel. We're terribly skinny. You know, your lot are a little bit, you know, how would we put it, weak around the core, a little bit chubby. And you can imagine one of the snooty scribes who's having a go at Jesus, as he points over to Peter. Peter's probably on his third steak sandwich at Levi's banquet. But it was a serious business, fasting. It said that you were serious about God. But Jesus is quick to defend them. And verse 34 is his defense. And Jesus said to them, can you make wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast in those days. See, there's nothing wrong with fasting in and of itself. There's a time and a place. But fasting is about religious sorrow. And one of the reasons they fasted was to express their desire for deliverance from sin and captivity. You know, how inappropriate to fast when the deliverer is standing right in front of you. You know, that would be as inappropriate as treating a wedding as if it was a funeral. You know, imagine a wedding, everyone in black, sort of wailing and gnashing of teeth as the bride comes down the aisle. I've been a best man a couple of times. Imagine a best man speech at a wedding like this. You know, hi everyone, I'm the best man. It's awful, isn't it? I mean, it's I guess like me, you've probably not been able to eat this meal that's been put in front of us. It's terrible, isn't it? You know, they got married. It's a time for celebration. It's a happy time. And the reason that the wedding illustration is so powerful is because it's not just an illustration. Actually, Jesus is the great bridegroom. And we've seen Luke quote a few times from the book of Isaiah, this big section from Isaiah chapter 40 onwards that describes God coming to deliver his people, to comfort them, to proclaim liberty. And one of the ways that God the deliverer is described is as a bridegroom. So Isaiah chapter 62, as a bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so shall your God rejoice over you. And not for the first time, Jesus reaches into the Old Testament, grabs some of the God language and says, here I am. I'm the thing that all the fasting was pointing towards. A person who's come to beautify you and to marry you and to delight over you. Isn't this bridegroom image a wonderful picture of what it means to know God? It says intimacy, it says relationship, and it says joy. Great news. Unless you think the old is good. You know, actually, we quite like the fasting, because the fasting was the way that we measured whose disciples were better than whose. And we knew who was winning. And don't tell us it's all about a relationship that any old sinner can just tap into. Well, what do you think? I think we could just about still feel some sympathy for the Pharisees at this point. Jesus is messing with their categories, and maybe it's just taking them some time to get used to him. Well, I think any sympathy starts to evaporate, doesn't it, as we move into chapter 6. So on the Sabbath, while he was going through the grain fields, his disciples plucked and ate some ears of corn, rubbing them in their hands. But some of the Pharisees said, why are you doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath? And don't you love it? The Pharisees are clearly hiding in the bushes somewhere lurking, probably dressed in grain-coloured camouflage. Yeah, they've got the binoculars out. They know exactly what they're looking for. Ha! We've caught you. I mean, they'd make brilliant traffic wardens, wouldn't they? If Pharisee, if Islington Council could get hold of a few of them, takings would go through the roof. And the issue here is not that Jesus' disciples are pinching from someone's field. The law said if you were passing, you were allowed to pick a handful, you know, as long as you didn't come along with some great scythe or sickle or combine harvester and hoover up the whole thing. You were allowed, if you were walking past, to pick up a few grains of corn and eat them. Now, the issue is that they did it on the Sabbath. God had set aside the Sabbath as a special day, no work on the Sabbath. But the Pharisees, see, with their love for the rules, they had turned Sabbath keeping basically into an Olympic sport that tested your religious prowess. They'd added this whole list of extra rules that would basically help to define what not working would mean. And the rules included no reaping, no threshing, no winnowing, no harvesting, all of which you appear to have done. And you can just see them writing out the tickets, slapping them onto the disciples. Again, Jesus jumps in to defend them. Verse 3, Jesus answered them, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry and those who were with him? How he entered the house of God and took and ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for any but the priest to eat, and also gave it to those with him." It's a genius way for Jesus to respond. Have you not read about that? You know, you seem to be pretty expert in your extra book of the extra made-up rules. Have you ever actually looked at what God's book has to say into a situation like this? Remember, not the Old Testament that was the problem. It was their twisted reading of it. And the thing is, God didn't write the law thinking, let's see if we can come up with some really interesting and tricky scenarios that will catch people out in extreme situations. So stomachs or sacredness, which one will they choose? And this is really going to sort out the men from the boys religiously. Yeah, that's not what God is like. Jesus is referring to something that happened in the life of King David. So King David and his fighting men, and the only food available to them was this special religious bread. Basically, the priest let them eat it, and nobody suggested that they were in any sense immoral because they'd done that. You know, you've missed the whole point of the law, says Jesus, if you think it's all about catching people out when they're in situations of physical need. Well, Jesus could leave it there. It's a pretty good defense. But what would you expect God to do in his defense if he was in this situation? You wouldn't expect God just to say, "You know, actually, sorry, we've checked the rules, and you know, it turns out my friends haven't broken the law. I'm really sorry." Now, you'd expect God to say, "I'll tell you what's right and wrong on the Sabbath." And that is exactly what Jesus does. Verse 5, "And he said to them, 'The Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath.'" It's not just that Jesus has found a neat little bit of legal precedent that backs up his argument. He made the Sabbath. He wrote the rules. "Get your hands off my day," is the point, which he underlines as we move on to the big showdown, the man with the withered hand, which is a setup, really, this situation. But Jesus becomes the one who's asking the questions. Verse 9. "And Jesus said to them, 'I ask you, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to destroy it?'" You know, it's pure hypocrisy that Jesus is exposing. Here the Pharisees are obsessed with certain rules, but for sure they are working on the Sabbath as well, aren't they? Working on their plot to how they're going to destroy Jesus, who is not in any way intimidated. He seems to make a point of making sure they're watching, and bold as anything, does the miracle that they've set him up to do. Because he's the Lord of the Sabbath. And that makes them seethe. Now, Jesus isn't saying here that the Sabbath doesn't matter. He's not saying that the new way is that anything goes. It's just that he's claiming to be the one who sets the rules. And the evidence so far is that having Jesus set the rules is brilliant, isn't it? So it turns out the Sabbath is a lot more about freedom and helping people than we realised before. That the new is good. Unless you like the old. Because, well, we had this system in place, Jesus, and we liked the system. Everybody knew where they stood with the system. We made sure they did. Well, what's your next move going to be when God tells you your religion is wrong? You've either got to change, or verse 11, but they were filled with fury and discussed with one another what they might do to Jesus. You see just how much the old and the new do not mix. If you think the old is good, then you won't like Jesus. And if you don't like Jesus, well, then he's just going to start everything again with a completely new nation of Israel. Now, that's what Jesus goes on to do as he picks 12 apostles. Remember, 12 tribes in Israel? These are the daddies who are going to be the heads of a whole new family of God. Well, that's the story of our passage this evening. We'll think now about some of the implications of what all of that means. Remember, Luke's big thing is that we have certainty concerning the things we have been taught. And just to think, first of all, about the uniqueness of Jesus as we see it here. So more reasons to bin your plastic Jesus here, full of reasons to do that. The bridegroom idea, it's massive and it's wonderful. God has arrived to marry his people. But see, the thing is, there only can be one bridegroom at the wedding, can't there? And what this is saying is this is not just some latest religious leader, you know, the disciples of John, the disciples of the Pharisees, the disciples of Jesus. You can't add him onto that kind of list. You could add all the other religious leaders onto that list. So the disciples of Muhammad, the disciples of Buddha. And this isn't meant to disrespect any of those other leaders as human beings. It's just that there's only one Jesus. There's only one bridegroom who all of the religious stuff people are supposed to do is pointing towards. Real faith, real piety are meant to be all about him. And that is not meant to sound sort of religiously domineering over other religions in a negative way. The Lord of the Sabbath thing, it could sound domineering, couldn't it, to think that you could just end the conversation with that line. So maybe we're having a sort of argument about the finer points of football, and then I suddenly say, end of conversation, I am the Lord of football. You know, that might be considered a little bit arrogant, mightn't it, if you thought you could do that. Well, it's not arrogant to talk like that if you really are the Lord. And I love Jesus here. The more they push him, the clearer he is, and the more he backs his enemies into a corner. Now, I guess it probably gives you a certain confidence about yourself when you know that you actually are God and that they can't do anything outside of your control. But there's no timid or weak Jesus here, is there? Powerful Jesus again. And politically incorrect Jesus, you've got to say. He's prepared to say to people, your religion is wrong. And that isn't really something that we're supposed to say nowadays, is it? But isn't it a great thing here that their religion is wrong? You know, Jesus' approach to fasting and the Sabbath, they're just so obviously so much better. He's about relationships and people and actually meaning things like love from the heart rather than just some cold, burdensome list that would lead people into pride and hypocrisy. It's great that they're wrong. And in that sense, it's great that all the other religions are wrong, because Jesus' way will always be a better way. It was great, wasn't it, to hear from John earlier about answers to prayer and ministry among Muslim people. You know, we're under such pressure, actually often not from religious people, from sort of the secular culture, to say that the big faiths are basically all the same. And you feel it so much, don't you, in a place like London, where it's so multicultural and cosmopolitan. As I was actually preparing for this on Friday, looking out the window of the flat, there were some of the local Muslim men and boys heading there to pray on Friday lunchtime. There's an Islamic centre over there on the Caledonian Road. And friends over in the East End from, you know, St. Helens that John talked about earlier, some of them talk about the great sense of neighbourliness that is often felt by them from Muslim people towards them. Now, I think probably a lot that we can learn if we've got more of a Western sense of what family and community life mean. We've got to speak the truth in love and in friendship and out of a concern for people's spiritual health. But we mustn't shy away from pointing people to the Jesus who says there's only one bridegroom at this wedding, only one Lord. So any religion that isn't all about me, says Jesus, now that is a wrong religion. And again, that is not a power play designed to score points, one faith system over the other. It's said in love by Jesus. It does mean that he's the only way, but it is so, so much a better way than any other or any old religion that you could know. It's tragic, really, isn't it? These Pharisees, they should be saying, wow, Jesus, this is brilliant. You're right, we don't need to fast because you're here. And yeah, we're sorry we got the Sabbath wrong. We couldn't see the wood for the trees. Your way is so clearly better and wiser and good. It's gutting, isn't it, that they can't see it? You know, it's mad in many ways to try and hold on to something old when something new and so much better is available. But actually, we shouldn't be surprised about it. As we move on to the second implication and just think about the attraction of religion, which is a big attraction in our city. John told us some stats that pointed towards that. It came out in the census last year that Londoners are disproportionately religious among the people of Britain. So this is an issue in our city. And part of the way that Luke wants to shore up our certainty about Jesus is he wants to help us to not be shaken when it feels like some people don't get Jesus. He especially wants us to help us make sense of that when it's people who we would think maybe should be the ones to make sense of Jesus. So what's wrong with these Pharisees? Well, it certainly isn't a problem with the evidence, isn't it? There's so many ironies in here. Just think about this incident with the man and the withered hand. What must the Pharisees actually believe about Jesus to think that they're going to catch him out here? So they must think he's really compassionate and really powerful. Oh, yeah, we know how compassionate and powerful you are, Jesus. You know, we're pretty sure that you're going to fall into this trap and heal the man. You know, if you're so sure he's so compassionate and powerful, you could just believe in him. Now, it's not a problem with the evidence. The problem is just the very simple thing of verse 39. They think the old is good. And it's really hard, isn't it? It's hard generally for people to break out of systems, religious systems that they've grown up with and that have run so deep. But hearts are the problem here. The problem is that Jesus undermines their system. It is their system. They police it. And they know how to keep themselves at the top end of the league table as they compare themselves to everyone else. And isn't that so much of what religion is about? Where am I in the pecking order? What are the rituals and works that I'm doing to make myself feel secure? You know, make myself feel secure about the things I'm doing. That's the other thing about religion, isn't it? It's all about me. And I think it's gutting, isn't it? The thing that's so gutting is their system that's meant to be about getting to know God actually makes them hate God when he shows up. Because, well, God's all about himself and Jesus and humility and the deeper commitment of an actual relationship. They're all about me and pride and a to-do list that I can just tick off and let my cold heart get back to whatever it actually loves. You know, the two do not mix. It doesn't mix work to try and have a bit of Jesus and latch him onto your system. It's not going to work. And I think that's the thing that's really frightening here. Being hooked on religion will make you actually hate God when you come face to face with him in the person of his son. Because he'll say things like, well, you're not righteous, and that you're a sinner, and that you need to change. You know, it's so hard for people to change, isn't it? That's why it's a miracle that any of us is a Christian. You know, we should think about this with a lot of humility if we're Christian people. It's a miracle that God has managed to change our hearts, and we're so grateful that he has. But we mustn't be surprised that so many in first century Judaism rejected Jesus. And we mustn't be surprised today when Pharisees from every religion prefer to think the old is good. You know, I was just thinking about earlier, I think you really have to believe in a God who can do the impossible, don't you? To think that religious people can become Christians. And thankfully, we have a God who is like that. So we need to pray, don't we? Pray that God will have mercy and be able to break into religiously proud hearts that don't want to change. Well, finally, just a word on the nature of true discipleship. So Jesus' disciples, they come in for a lot of the flack here, don't they? It's always tempting when we're applying passages like this to disciples of Jesus to say, don't be like the Pharisees, you know, don't be legalistic. But it's not just like they're God's people, but you know, they're a little bit legalistic and they need to cut that out. You know, this is completely another religion that these guys are into here. And so I think the application is more that we don't be intimidated by people like this, is the point. And I think religion can be quite an intimidating thing, can't it? You know, when you look at people who are so into pilgrimages and pillars, stuff that maybe we don't do, it could shake you up. So maybe we should be doing that stuff, should we? To be sure that we're properly in. I think that could be particularly an issue for those of us from families or cultures or countries where rituals and ceremonies have been a big part of our religious background. You know, maybe this new faith in Jesus just looks a little bit too simple sometimes. Well, Jesus has come to call sinners to repentance. He hasn't come to call them to religion. And what that means in practice is just that it's very simple. It's about listening to Jesus through his apostles, the guys who get mentioned there, the family heads who we connect to Jesus through. It means taking your lead from Jesus. So if Jesus says that something is fine, that means it's fine. If he says you don't have to do it, then that means you don't have to do it. And there are commands in Christianity. We're going to look at some of them over the next couple of weeks. We'll see that they're beautiful and in many ways actually a higher, deeper standard than some of the rules of the Pharisees. But if we are God's people, the encouragement here is don't be unsettled by man-made rules and things other people do that just aren't in the Bible. Just keep listening to Jesus. Just keep listening to his apostles. And you can be sure that that is always the better way. It's the only way, actually, that means you can be certain that we are the true people of God. Well, some hard things there, aren't there? I'd love us to keep talking about these things at the end of our meeting. I hope we'll get the chance to do that. I'd love to chat more if that would be a help. We're going to turn to pray now, and Al is going to come and lead us.